Welcome to the Fretboard Journal podcast. I am Jason Verlinde, the publisher of the Fretboard Journal. And as always, that is John Rauhaus playing the pedal steel in the background. I want to thank everyone for listening in and telling your friends about this podcast, as well as for leaving us all those reviews on iTunes. It's all working. The show is growing very quickly. We have a lot of new stuff brewing. I'm talking to some pretty cool, exciting future guests, including a few folks who are kind of off the wall and may throw you for a loop, but definitely have some good music tales to share. So I hope you will stick with us. Speaking of music tales, today I'm talking to the one and only Jazz Obrecht. Jazz, of course, was the editor of Guitar Player magazine for some 20 years, some 20 very important years when it came to guitar media. It was quite a pivotal time. He's authored numerous books, and he has a brand new anthology called Talking Guitar: Conversations with Musicians Who Shaped 20th Century American Music. I have been reading this book for the last couple of months. I love it. I think you will too. If you are reading the Fretboard Journal, it is definitely up your alley. It features great interviews with heroes like Nick Lucas, Ry Cooder, Pop Staples, Jerry Garcia, and Dwayne Allman. He tells us all about it in this conversation, but you should definitely check it out if you can. I know it's on Kindle as well as paper version. And if you are looking for more things to read this summer, I was a little inspired by this book, so I decided to do a little more writing, and I just posted a list of my recommended summer reading for summer 2017 over on fretboardjournal.com. It's got Jazz's book. It's got 10 or so other books that I think you will love, things that I've been reading personally. And, you know, occasionally you find yourself at a campsite or a beach where it's just too hot to bring a guitar out. And that's when you pull out the phone and start reading books, or pull out the paper edition and start reading books. So check that out if that's up your alley. Our sponsor today is, once again, Retrofret Vintage Guitars. As always, they have so many new arrivals at their Brooklyn showroom that it's a tad overwhelming. But right now, I am eyeing a lovely, lovely, lovely Gibson Black Special No. 4 Archtop from 1937. Have you heard of this thing? I hadn't. I used to own a black L10, and I hadn't even heard of it. But this is a 16-inch arch top, kind of like an L50, a little more pared down. It is absolutely gorgeous. They also landed a 1968 Gibson Melody Maker. Those two guitars are very different, but they both are pretty great values if you need an old Gibson in your life. They also have a 1968 Guild Starfire 5 available that just came in, and on and on. They do top-notch repairs and restorations, and as I tell you every week, if you are near New York City and you have yet to make the trek to their showroom, you are truly missing out. Go to retrofret.com, tell them the Fretboard Journal sent you, follow their Instagram, you know the routine. In other news, the Fretboard Journal 39 is here. It is showing up in stores, it is showing up in mailboxes. I know the USPS can work in strange ways, but all of you subscribers will be seeing it over the next week or so. So much great stuff in that issue, including our first big contribution from Nils Klein of Wilco. I hope it is the first of many. We are hard at work on issue 40 right now and trying to make that issue as special as possible. 40 is kind of a big number. Got to pull out all the stops. As always, if you want to really support us and the podcast and all that we do, just subscribe at fretboardjournal.com. It's $40 for a year. We take credit cards, we take PayPal, we take Amazon payments. You could send us a vintage guitar in trade, whatever it takes. Okay, I'm done rambling. Here is my conversation with Jazz Obrecht. His new book is called Talking Guitar, and it is a great read. I hope you will check it out. Thanks so much for tuning in. Well, Jazz, I wanted to talk to you because this new book that just came out, Talking Guitar, which is kind of an anthology of some of your interviews over the years, is fascinating. I bought it. I love it. It's great. It's the perfect summer read for a guitarist out there. Can you kind of talk to me a little bit about the origin of this book?
Sure. The origin of the book came in 1978 when I got hired by Guitar Player magazine. And the first day I walked into the office, I really had a sense that what I was doing had some kind of historic significance and I should document things and keep things. You know, like notes and letters and copies of my conversations with people. And I really felt like I kind of owed it to humanity, I guess, to keep all these materials because I felt like someday they'd be worthwhile. And, you know, years went by, and as I moved, I carried around these 6 or 8 tubs full of cassette recordings and files, you know, file cabinets full of paper materials and stuff. And then when my father passed away about 4 or 5 years ago, I started thinking, like, what's going to happen to this material when I'm gone? You know, my wife and daughter know I'm a music journalist, but they don't know who Randy Rhodes is, or maybe even, you know, Ricky Nelson, people like that. So I was concerned about what would happen to all these raw materials. And my friend Bill Ferris came to pay me a visit in Ann Arbor here, and I expressed my concern to Bill, and Bill said, well, the Southern Folklife Collection at the University of North Carolina would love to have all these materials. And so in the process of organizing these materials, I just kept seeing like books that could be made out of different pieces of it. And I pitched the American Talking Guitar book to UNC Press, and they said yes, and it was really a pleasure to write it.
Yeah, let's go back a bit. 1978, you start at Guitar Player, and you know, this is obviously, for a lot of us, we consider this sort of the golden age of guitar journalism. What your work there was, you know, it's definitely held its own and set a very, very high bar for everyone, including myself, who's followed. Where were you at in life when you started at Guitar Player? Were you already a music journalist? What were you doing?
I had finished grad school at Ohio University, and I moved back home to Detroit, and I was working for a publisher in downtown Detroit, starving because I was so poorly paid. And during our, the place I worked for got all these magazines from around the world, like hundreds of magazines would come in every month, and during my breaks I would go into the storage room and I would pull out copies of Living Blues and Guitar Player and flip through them. And I used to look at Guitar Player because, you know, I'd played guitar for 12 years by then. And I would see in the front of the magazine was a column called Prose Reply, written by Dan Fort. Mm-hmm. And I used to think, this guy has the best life in the world, because every month he gets to hang out with somebody important, a guitarist. So I sent off my resume to a lot of different companies, and my resume got to Guitar Player magazine the same day Dan resigned. And Don Menn, the editor at the time, sort of, the way he's explained it to me, he sort of thought it was a sign from God that he should hire me. And so they flew me out, and I loved what I saw. I loved the whole concept of working on a guitar magazine. And I had no idea at all what California would be like, so that was kind of a surprise, too, to leave Detroit on a snowy, cold day and land in the land of palm trees was quite amazing. And after I was hired, they brought me back about a week later, and the next night I was backstage talking to Jorma Kaukonen from Jefferson Airplane, who was one of my boyhood heroes, and so I thought, this is the life for me.
That was your first interview?
It wasn't really an interview. I was asking him about some of the effects he was using on an acoustic guitar record. He ran something through an MXR flanger.
Yeah.
And I didn't know what a flanger was at that time, but I think my first big interview was Eddie Van Halen.
That's a good one to start with.
Yeah, and he asked me to do it. I didn't ask him.
Nice.
Those were the days, huh?
Yeah, I mean, you cover so many amazing figures. I mean, everyone from Nick Lucas to Eddie Van Halen to Neil Young to Jerry Garcia in here. Do you have any interviews that were your absolute favorites that still stand out?
No, you know, I think my favorite person to do an interview with was John Lee Hooker. And my interviews with John are all in a book called Rollin' and Tumblin', so I didn't put any of them in the Talking Guitar book. But I just loved him as a human being, and I thought he was just a wonderful person, and it was like being around an Illuminati or just someone with his great presence.
Yeah.
Somebody who was, John couldn't read or write, but boy, was he wise. And so I got to interview him maybe 6 or 7 times, and we didn't live that far from each other, and I had what I felt like was a good friendship with him. The other person I always loved speaking to is Eric Johnson.
Yeah. What do you love about Eric, aside from his music?
I like his personality. I like his outlook on life. I like his humility. I like his dedication to his art. And I love his playing. Boy, is he a terrific guitar player. Just, I'd go a long way out of my way to watch Eric play any time.
Yeah.
Very generous person.
You included an interview with Jerry Garcia that you did for Frets where he basically takes like coke out right in front of you. I have to imagine some of these artists were pretty intimidating, or some intimidating moments happened. Can you talk about any?
You know, I never. The only time I ever felt intimidated talking to an artist was when I mentioned Yorma.
Mm-hmm.
I remember meeting him backstage. It was my first important encounter with a musician, and I remember my leg was sort of bouncing up and down nervously, and I thought to myself, I can't do that. I can't be this way. And so I just took a deep breath and kind of let it go. And I never actually felt it again. I used to think it was remarkable because I would have no compunction about calling up Chet Atkins or going to do an interview with somebody in the Stones. But it would make me nervous to call the teller at the bank to ask her on a date. And my secretary, I expressed that to her one time, and she said, yeah, Jazz, that's because the teller can reject you. But no, people really wanted to talk to Guitar Player. It was amazing because we had a great reputation. You know, we didn't publish gossip. We weren't asking questions about scandals. We were really into the music, and the three other editors on the staff at that time, and we may have been the only full-time Guitar Magazine editors in North America at that point, were Tom Mulhern, Tom Wheeler.
Yeah.
We had a crew, and Don Menn, the head editor, we had a crew of about seven people putting out that magazine every month, but it was really fun, and it was like being in a family, and I liked it so much I stayed there for 20 years.
Yeah. Yeah, the style of interview that you did, and it's throughout this book, is so refreshing compared to how most interviews take place these days. You know, you don't cut straight to the what string gauge do you use, like all the typical guitar magazine questions. You kind of, you know, you talk about influences, you talk about technique. There was really an arc to the conversation, which I really loved.
I did my work. I mean, I did a lot of homework before I spoke to anybody. If I were going to interview like Gatemouth Brown or Jerry Garcia or whomever, I would read everything I could get my hands on about that artist. I would listen to their entire catalogs. In those days, when you were going to do an interview, the record company would send you the person's catalog, meaning everything they'd ever recorded. And I would listen to the whole thing chronologically. And so by the time I got on the phone or sat down with the person in real life, I felt like I not only knew their music inside out, but I also knew what they'd been asked many times before, and I knew what to avoid. So I think that kind of preparation paid off. The other thing that we had going for us was we had fairly unlimited space. Like your magazine, you know, you could do a 9,000-word piece on Cooter.
Sure.
And Guitar Player back in the 70s and 80s, you know, I could go 2,500 words on a cover story. And then by the late 90s, it was like, yeah, go ahead and interview you too, but we can give you 300 words. And I just thought, this isn't for me. I view what we're doing in a different way, where I wasn't comfortable truncating things like that.
You mentioned doing your research, but I imagine like in that era, talking to someone like Nick Lucas, this is pre-Wikipedia, pre-Google, obviously, there wasn't a ton of information about some of these artists. Am I correct?
Yeah, but I lived in the San Francisco Bay Area, and my first week on the job, I asked the publisher, this wonderful guy named Jim Crockett, if I could build up a library. And he said, sure, go for it. We'll just reimburse you. And I went out and bought, I had a VW Bug at the time, and I would fill up the back seat with books related to guitar. I'd go to all the bookstores in San Francisco and Oakland, and just, I built a library that was probably like, I don't know, 50 feet of books. And then we had a very large record library as well. So there was, and we had back issues of Rolling Stone and different magazines. So there was plenty to go through.
Yeah, and back in the day, was it? Did you have like an assignment of one piece per issue or anything, or did you kind of free reign?
No, it was always a lot more than that.
Yeah,
and initially we worked on typewriters, and at the beginning of the month, Don Menn would hand me a little brown piece of paper that would have maybe two or three stories that I would write, and then I'd do my column, prose reply. And then I would edit Tommy Tedesco and Barney Kessel and Jeff Baxter and various people, Michael Lorimer and various people. So, you know, it was a set routine.
Very cool.
But I was given a great deal of freedom. You know, we'd ship the boards out around the 15th of the month, and I'd talk to the editor and say, you know, here are the people I'm interested in doing. And about 95% of the time, they gave me the green light to pretty much do what I wanted.
Yeah. I imagine there is a whole slew of other interviews that didn't make it into this book that you want to have see the light of day. Am I correct?
Yeah, probably about 600 more. It's funny you should say that, because for the past 8 days I've been preparing them all. They're leaving. They're permanently leaving me the day after tomorrow and going off to be in the Southern Folklife Collection. So I'm saying goodbye to my 40-year collection.
Yeah. I have to ask, I know you went back and retranscribed all these. Did all the tapes survive? Were there any that broke on you?
Yes. No.
That's amazing.
No. In fact, most of the tapes were only heard once. I did all my own transcribing, which I strongly encourage any music journalist to do, because you learn when to shut up and let the other person talk. But no, the tapes were in beautiful shape, and you know, I'm sort of an archivist by nature. I used to work in as a reference librarian in college, so I knew how to store things and how to keep it away from metal and magnets and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, the sound on them is pristine.
That's great. And do you know what the museum's plans are? Are they going to digitize them or anything?
Yes, everything will be digitized. All the papers will be scanned. I have hundreds of letters and things like that. And I just felt like this stuff should belong to the world. It shouldn't be like in my basement in 15 file cabinets. It should go out to the... It should belong to people who love music and love these artists.
Yeah. Are there any pieces of paper or ephemera that you're holding on to that just have too much meaning?
It's funny you should say that, because I've chosen one thing to keep, which is Eric Johnson sent me a tape of his earliest album called Seven Worlds.
Uh-huh.
And it's got his handwriting on it, and he writes copyright 1976 or 78 on it or whatever. And I had that thing years and years and years before it was ever released, and I just thought, this is such a good memory. This will be the one thing I keep to remember the guitar player times.
That's very cool. So the book is Talking Guitar. Everyone listening to this should definitely pick it up. What's next for you?
I have an August 25th deadline for a book on Jimi Hendrix, which I'm writing on 6 or 8 hours a day. And I'll make the deadline. I think it'll be a good book. It's fun to do, because I always loved Jimmy. I wrote a book with his father called My Son Jimmy, but that was more Al telling his version of Jimi Hendrix's life, and the whole book is in his words. And this is my chance to write, you know, my own thoughts and feelings about Jimmy, and I'm focusing on the first year or so of his life with the Experience.
Nice.
And then after that, I either want to write another book about early blues music or do the European... and, you know, UK version of Talking Guitar.
Nice. Are you still playing guitar much yourself?
A lot.
And
I play a little bit every day.
And what style do you turn to when you pick up a guitar?
It's original. It's funny. I never was one to, like, learn other people's material very much. So I pick up a guitar and I make up songs. Sometimes there's a commercial on, I'll start singing lyrics that make up lyrics that coincide with whatever words are on the screen or what's going on the screen to make my wife and daughter laugh, you know?
Yeah. I love it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, Jazz, thank you so much for talking to us. This was great. And I can't recommend
your
book
enough.
Can I
add something?
Yeah, of course.
Can I add something?
Yeah.
When I wrote the book, let me you're going to splice this. When I got to Guitar Player, I thought, okay, my biggest inspiration as an interviewer was reading Living Blues magazine, because Living Blues would ask questions to blues artists and they would answer and in their own language, and Living Blues would publish it, so you got a sense of the flavor of someone's language. And at Guitar Player and other mainstream music magazines, you would interview somebody and write the article, and it would typically go through several editors. Maybe a copy editor, a fact checker, a proofreader, et cetera. And people would make changes to the language. And so there was kind of a homogenization that went on with the way people spoke. But when I would get together with musicians, I would notice that very often the rhythm of their language would match the rhythm of their music. In other words, John Lee Hooker would speak with this low kind of stuttering voice, you know, like, you gots to go. And he'd talk like that. And so I thought, it'd be wonderful to transcribe the tapes in a way that completely and accurately mirrors the way the person speaks. And so for talking guitar, I thought it was really important to do things word for word. And I listened to some of those passages 5-10 times to make sure I nailed it exactly the way they spoke it. Because I remember doing a cover story on Charlie Christian, probably around 81, 82 maybe, and I actually found an article that was bylined by Charlie Christian in Downbeat from like 1940 or 41, and I thought, there's no way in the world this is the way Charlie Christian spoke. And I thought this was a disservice to music fans everywhere, and so I always wanted to move towards doing exact transcriptions, and so with the Talking Guitar book, I finally was given that opportunity.
That's great. That's awesome. I'm curious, you were around for such a pivotal time in the world of guitarists. You had the elder statesmen like, you know, Nick Lucas. You have the young guns like Ben Harper.
Say that again.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, you...
I can't hear you.
Can you hear me now? Hello?
Yeah.
Okay. I was just going to ask you, you were around at such a pivotal time in the world of guitar culture. You had elder statesmen.
Lost your voice.
Again? Oh, no.
Are you on a cell phone?
No, I'm on Skype. Is it? I've never had this happen. You can't hear me?
Now I can hear you fine.
Okay. The time that you were at Guitar Player was such a pivotal time for the world of guitars. You had elder statesmen like Nick Lucas. You had young guns like Ben Harper, who's in this issue. What do you think of the world of guitar players today? And is there anyone of the current crop of musicians that you would have loved to have interviewed?
I'll be honest with you. By the mid-1990s, I was finished with trying to keep up with everything. Mm-hmm. I felt like this is something for younger people to do, somebody with the energy. You know, I'd reached a point where I'd interviewed Eddie Van Halen 6 or 7 times, Keith Richards several times. The list goes on and on. And I became more and more interested in the earlier music, the music that came between 1890 and 1940 or 1950, and I started exploring those areas. And so I didn't get deeply into grunge and the post-grunge guitar music, and so I couldn't really speak with any authority on who's who today. I'm more interested in the happenings back during what I consider the golden age of guitar, which was between the late 1950s and, you know, the early 1980s.
Of course. Makes perfect sense. Mm-hmm. Well,
the sad thing is I look through my phone book. I kept an address book the whole time I worked at Guitar Player, and on every 2-page spread, most of the people have passed away.
Yeah.
There's very, you know, fewer and fewer people left, and, you know, the passage of time. So I felt like it's important to get this material out while it still exists and I can still do it.
Definitely. Well, I'm really glad you did it. It's a great book.
And I got to say, I'm really impressed with Fretboard Journal. You've put together a beautiful publication.
Thank you. Well, we were deeply inspired by your work.
The artwork knocks me out, but I love the writing as well. And so congratulations on that. I want to tell all the people listening to read the Ry Cooter interview.
Okay.
Because I actually read every word of it and really enjoyed it. I know Ry well, and he's an interesting guy to interview, and you did it very well.
Yeah, I'm very grateful that Ry took the time to talk to us. That was not an easy interview to get, and he delivered. It was great.
Yeah. He's a great guy. He's very knowledgeable. You know, once in a while you run into somebody who not only plays well, but really knows what happened before, and Ry's one of those guys.
Definitely. Well, Jazz, thank you so much.
Sure, and if you want to ask me anything else, feel free to call me.